What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Iranian Jewish author and poet Roya Hakakian. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We've put Pesach behind us now, and while it is an amazing festival of freedom, it's also a week of matzah, which is not so amazing, especially when you've been eating it for 7 days. Thank goodness, all that is in the past. This was an interesting year here where I live in Tucson, Arizona. It was actually quite hard to find the food you need for Passover in the stores, and certainly difficult to find it in the right quantities. I mean, there was matzah, but not the kind we actually prefer. I use that word loosely, streitzes. And there were almost none of the 5-pound packages of matzah we use over the holiday. And it took at least 4 trips or 5 to different grocery stores and the kosher market just to gather the stuff we usually can get in the kosher section of our own Safeway. What went wrong? Well, apparently stores cut way back on their kosher for Passover buying this year for whatever reason. Maybe it was the recession. Maybe people bought less Pesach stuff than last year. Maybe it's suddenly widespread anti-Semitism. You know, our market will absolutely not let those darn Jews increase their personal suffering on leaven-free products bought in this store. Maybe Bashir Assad's Syrian secret police captured all the decent Pesachic food and sunk it in the Mediterranean. Maybe there's some sort of crisis in the anti-yeast world, but for whatever reason, it was pretty darn tough to get the stuff you needed for Passover. In fact, I purchased the very last horseradish root in Tucson, I think, about 3 days before the first Seder. Of course, now that all the festive feasting on leaven-free food is done, even with all the stress getting the streitzes into our home, it turns out that we still have a whole lot of one substance left. You guessed it, matzah, the one thing nobody wants to eat after Passover. So, what do you do with all the leftover unleavened bread? Well, here are Michelle Citron's suggestions in song.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah big and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
Insulate.
Decorate.
9. Exfoliate.
10.
Constipate. Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah doghouse for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye. Or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzah jewelry. Make a picture frame for me. Have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
That was Michelle Citrin's very funny exploration of what you can do with all your leftover matzah after Passover. A non-Passover-related funny moment from last week, Jon Stewart had former NBA great Shaquille O'Neal on his The Daily Show, and besides the inherently amusing size differential between the 7'1", 350-pound Shaq, at least 350 pounds, and the rather diminutive, if very talented, Stewart, they shared this terrific exchange about Stewart's son's basketball potential.
My son now, first of all, he's a huge fan of yours. He loves basketball. And he's saying to me, you know, I would love to be a professional basketball player. I would love to do that. And I don't know at what age do I break to him that he's Jewish. Like, I don't know. Like, how do you even say that?
Well, when you see him tonight, tell him Uncle Shaq says Barak Hashem. Tell him that. Tell him that. And then.
Nice. Uncle Shaq.
And then tell him Lashana Tova. And then tell him Mazel Tov. And then tell him that he can make it. He can make it.
You know what? I am going to tell him that, and I'm going to encourage him.
I admit that Shaquille O'Neal's Hebrew is a little weak. I mean, it's pronounced Baruch Hashem. And it's even a bit out of season. You say Lashana Tova for Rosh Hashanah, not Pesach. But still, pretty darn good stuff from a Hall of Fame NBA center and major celebrity like Shaq. I can't quite see Kobe Bryant doing that. Or even Kareem. Well, we do appreciate the shout-outs from non-Jewish celebrities, don't we? I mean, Madonna made Kabbalah popular for everyone, didn't she? I'm not sure if that reflects our Jewish insecurity or just the fact that we love that it's kind of cool to be Jewish now, and we revel in it. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments, we'll meet our guest, the fascinating and courageous Iranian-Jewish author and poet Roya Hakakian. Find out what it's like to be Jewish in Iran these days when we return on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, "To find balance in life is to find happiness." Now, I assume he was a smart guy being a philosopher and all, so it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this. What one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese, heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce, crispy crust or lightly done crust. It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, author and poet Roya Hakakian. She has written movingly about her experience and about Iran. She's an author and originally a Farsi poet whose columns, essays, and book reviews have appeared in publications like the New York Times, Newsweek, The Daily Beast, The Wall Street Journal, and has been on NPR's All Things Considered. She's a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, has collaborated on over a dozen hours of programming for leading journalism units on network TV, including 60 Minutes.
She has two collections of poetry in Persian, is listed among the leading new voices in Persian poetry in the Oxford Encyclopedia of the Modern Islamic World. She has two more recent books out, Journey from the Land of No, and the fascinating book, Assassins of the Turquoise Palace. We welcome the two Jewish Roya Hakakian. Good morning.
Good morning.
Your family was a Jewish family in Tehran, and part of sort of the great exodus of Jews from Iran, a Jewish community that dated back perhaps 3,000 years. Tell us a little bit about that experience. You came over in 1985?
That's right. I found that to be such an important and misunderstood aspect of my history and the history of the Iranian Jewish community that it really became an incentive for me to switch from writing poetry in Persian, as you mentioned in your introduction, to writing in English, which ended up becoming my memoir about growing up Jewish during the Iranian Revolution, Journey from the Land of No. I think the transformation of life from the years that led to 1979, the Iranian Revolution of 1979, the arrival of Ayatollah Khomeini on the scene in Iran, and the subsequent years, because my mother and I left together in 1984, and it took us about a year to get to the United States, are really essential years to not just for those who are interested in the Middle East, but especially for Jews and Jewish history, and I think it's something that we know here in this country very little about.
You know, in the interest of full disclosure, I had an Iranian sort of younger brother who came over ahead of his family in the late 70s and lived at my parents' house. They were bringing some Iranian Jews over when they could get out early on after Khomeini took over. So I know a little bit about this, but your experience as a Persian poet, I mean, writing in Farsi, to leave your homeland must have been extremely painful.
Exactly. And I remember one of the things that used to really offend me and upset me when I first arrived in the U.S. in 85 was to come across people who would ask me where I was from, and I would tell them, and then they would immediately say, then you must be relieved and delighted to be here. And it wasn't that, you know, there wasn't a certain amount of delight to be had about being in the United States, but most of all being reunited with my brothers who had been here for several years before we arrived. But you know, the assumption that anybody, regardless of what troubled countries or backgrounds they come from, would naturally want to be here and, you know, in a way, not acknowledging and recognizing the pains of being uprooted and unsettled was very astounding to me. Iran and the history of the Jewish community in Iran is, in many ways, something that I think we would all benefit from knowing. You know, the fact that some people refer to it, even Benjamin Netanyahu refers to, you know, the Iranian president as, you know, a second Hitler, creates a certain degree of confusion, not just about the regime, but also about the condition of the Jews, which in no way, shape, or form resembles the lives of Jews in Germany. It's a very complicated and complex landscape of a coexistence with Muslims who are also in many ways suffering in different ways than the Jews, but suffering nonetheless.
We will talk much more with Roya Hakakian and explore her really fascinating newish book, The Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, when we come back this morning on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcasts. The last call for the Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, May 30th to June 10th of this year. If you're interested in going, call 520-327-4501, or better yet, email us at twojewishradio, twojewishradio@yahoo.com. One final Passover cut for the very end of Pesach. It's from the National Jewish Outreach Institute, headed by an old friend, Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald. This one was created and sung by Brian Golub and Mike Kirsch about the best Seder.
Woke up in bed at the corner of Lex with a dream of how it used to be. Remembering the time of the Exodus and how the Jews were set free. Jumped in the cab, throwing a Seder for the first time. Look to the right and I see the Manischewitz sign. I'm hosting my first Seder, so please don't be a hater. My tummy's turning, hope my Seder is amazing. So much pressure that I'm schwitzing. That's when the matzah man turned on the radio. The Dayenu song was on. And the Dayenu song was on. And the Dayenu song was on. So I put my yarmulke on, they're playing my song. And the butterflies fly away. Cleaning it up like, yeah. Grinding it up like, yeah. Fill the wine up in Elijah's cup. I know it's gonna be okay. Yeah. The best Seder in the USA. Yeah. The best Seder in the USA. Get to my house in the taxi cab. Everybody's looking at me now. Like, who's that kid that's rocking sixes? It's gotta be from out of town. So hard with comets not around me. It's definitely not an Easter party. Cause all I see are Haggadah. Good thing I got the memo. My tummy's turning, hope my Seder is amazing. So much pressure that I'm schwitzing. This morning JM in the AM drum, my favorite tune.
And the Haggadah song was on.
And the Haggadah song was on. And the Haggadah song was on. So I put my yarmulke on, they're playing my song. And the butterflies fly away. Breaking it up like, yeah. Lean to the left like, yeah. Fill the wine up in Elijah's cup. I know it's gonna be okay. Yeah. The best Seder in the USA. Yeah.
That was Brian Golub singing Best Seder in the USA. A last look at Passover. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And happy post-Pesach. You know, if it's after Passover, that means, first of all, you don't have to eat matzah anymore, thank God. And second of all, that Yom HaShoah, the Holocaust Remembrance Day, is not far away. It comes up this week.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about the observance of Yom HaShoah in Israel.
Yom HaShoah is a very special day in Israel. It's a day with a lot of pain and sorrow and memory, but also I think with a lot of pride, in a sense. I think a lot of Israeli families, probably more than half of the families that live in Israel, have someone that died in the Holocaust. I know I do, and all the people I know either know someone that died or have a close relative who died. At the end of the day, a third of our people were killed at that day. It's also interesting to note, you know, that there was a talk a while ago by Aleph Bet Yoshua, A.B. Yoshua, the famous author.
Great writer.
And he started his talk by saying that we always look at the Holocaust and we look at the aggressor, at the Germans. We look at the European nations that attacked or supported the Germans in attacking the Jews. We have never looked at the Holocaust from the perspective of the Jewish failure in it. And it's a very provocative thing.
It's very controversial when he said
Very controversial. But what he basically, I think what he basically means, looking at the Jewish history at the last 2,000 years, Jews were attacked over and over and over and over again. You know, just a very, very general glance in history. In 1096, the Crusaders, on their way to Jerusalem, slaughtered thousands of Jews across Europe. 100 years later, okay, 1190, the entire York Jewish community was slaughtered to death.
Right, and then the Jews shortly thereafter expelled from England.
Expelled from England, and we have the expulsion from Spain and from French, and of course massacres in Russia, and we had in the 17th century a big massacre in Iran. And also in the beginning even of this century here in the States, we had occasions of anti-Semitism, very violent anti-Semitism. One can remember occasions with the KKK and others. And Aleph Bet Yehoshua comes and asks the question, how come we did not prepare? How come we, as the Jewish people, didn't do anything along our history to be able to protect our own people? And in a sense, I think in Israel, every Yom HaShoah there is a siren. And people are standing.
Silently.
Silently. No cars are riding. Nobody. The birds are standing in silence. And for those, you know, those seconds of the sirens, this minute, you kind of think this is the first time in history where we, the Jewish people, are a nation, a part of the nations. We have our own army, our own Jewish hands protecting us. And I think that this is something that today we tend to take too much for granted. And we need to know that it's unique in our history for the last 2,000 years, and it's not something that we can give up.
Yeah. Thank you, Guy, for the observation from an Israeli point of view. Might also add, you know, it clearly influences discussion on things like Iran today and nuclear weaponry. You know, this isn't just a memory of a Holocaust that took place in 1939 to 1945. By the way, this Thursday at Temple Emmanuel at 7 o'clock, we'll be doing a Yom HaShoah commemoration on Ma'amin, Elie Wiesel's great play. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Trust that you had a good Pesach. We started talking last week about a controversy that took place in the Roman Jewish community in the Middle Ages. They had to call a rabbi in from Israel to settle the dispute, and they settled it by building a big wall between them. Obviously, there's something about the fractious quality of Jewish life that is eternal. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the nature of that. You've been everywhere in the Jewish world. You know, we could say it starts with the Talmud, but it precedes the Talmud. The Talmud is basically 60-some volumes of argument. What is there about Jewish communities that everywhere seem to cultivate this quality?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think an even more basic question is this a Jewish quality, or are Jews just sort of so self-aware and neurotically examining and analyzing themselves all the time that Jews are more aware of this problem than other people? Because
would you ask that question, Tom? Right, I don't know.
Right. So, I mean, if you read the book of Genesis, you look at the story of Cain and Abel.
The first siblings. No, they weren't
right.
Jewish.
But they were certainly disputatious and fractious.
It's a killer of a story.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, I think one of the questions has to be, is this a particularly Jewish quality, or do Jews just make more jokes about it? And then, however you answer that, when you look through Jewish history and see examples going back to, so what happens to all the Jews who are waiting at the bottom of Mount Sinai when Moses goes up to receive Torah and revelation? Is one of the implications that once you're enlightened by Torah, you no longer have disputes, that everybody's united, and only those people below who had not yet received God's word are arguing with each other? But no, because after we get the Ten Commandments and we get divine revelation, we're still fractious and disputatious, and we have, as you pointed out earlier, 60 volumes of Talmud to prove that. We always have, at the minimum, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. I mean, we have like two approaches at least to everything. So I'm not sure why that is. I'm not sure if it's a specifically Jewish thing. I'm not sure if it's ever going to go away. I'm not sure in the long term that it is necessarily even a bad thing. It may just be part of human nature. What do you think?
I think it's part of human nature, but I think we are definitely more argumentative than most people out there. And in fact, I remember a comedian talking about how he's married to somebody who isn't Jewish, and she said to him, you know, why are you fighting with me all the time? He said, I'm not fighting. I'm just talking. You know, this is how we are. This is how we do things. It's just how we decide to explore the world. It makes Jews really good at law and science and film criticism and lots of other things, but it doesn't make us very good cheerleaders. And I think it's part of the nature of our culture, whether it's persecution or just the need to know and to push ourselves in a way that we're not naturally just going to go along, that means that we're going to be critical people. I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily, although it certainly can be, but there's a reason there's so many Jewish Nobel Prize winners, because they didn't believe what everybody told them and they went a different route. And sometimes they're right.
So not accepting conventional wisdom is part and parcel of being Jewish.
It's like that great Gentile joke. Somebody says, you're wrong. And the Gentile says, okay, I'm sorry. A Jew would never say that.
Maybe.
We'll talk next week, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Morris gets a new dog and can't wait to show him off to his friend Shlomo. He calls the dog into the house, bragging about how smart he is. The dog quickly comes running, stands looking up at his master, tail wagging furiously, mouth open, tongue hanging out, eyes bright with anticipation. Morris points to the newspaper on the couch and commands, "Fetch!" Immediately, the dog climbs onto the couch and sits down. His tail wagging stops, the doggy's smile disappears. Looking balefully up at his master, the dog says in a whiny voice, "You think this is easy, wagging my tail all the time? Oy vey. It hurts from the wagging. And do you think this expensive organic dog food you're feeding me is good? You try it. It's dreck. And you just don't care about me anymore. You push me out the door to go pee 3 times a day. Can't remember the last time you took me for a decent walk." His friend Shlomo is amazed. "My God, Morris, that's fantastic. You asked him to fetch the paper. Instead, the dog is sitting there talking to us, complaining like a person. Amazing." "Yeah, I know," explains Morris. "He's a little hard of hearing. He thought I said kvetch." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well and kvetch. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Tazria Metzora in the book of Leviticus, and a wholly unappetizing set of portions it is indeed. Metzora in particular focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease of the ancient world, but mostly an archaic and kind of disgusting section for us today. It's true that leprosy was an awful thing and needed to be eliminated if at all possible, in particular by using the concept of quarantines to isolate it. but exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length during a Shabbat service can scarcely be called a spiritually meaningful experience. The rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem long ago and came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word mitzorah, which means leprosy, was itself, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew, motzi shem ra, which means slander or evil speech. There is a legal concept in American jurisprudence called the fruit of the poisoned tree, which rules out the use of evidence collected illegally. That is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted and not legally admissible. So it is with mitzorah and all other forms of lashon hara, evil speech. Whether the gossip has elements of truth in it or not, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupt source. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, the awful tendency we have to speak ill of others. Commit no slander and your own life will be clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that damage others, we can find our way clear to living better, holier lives. In the portion this week, it even delineates forms of mitzorah that affect the very houses in which we live, mitzorah ad bayit. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of the property, it may even need to be destroyed, the Torah tells us. It's along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And so, if we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations, synagogues, and communities in which holiness can truly flourish, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated as well. May we each do our part, now and always, to remove mitzorah, personal impurities of speech, from our lives. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Roya Hakakian, will share her extraordinary story about leaving Iran and her whole culture to become a Jewish author in the West, and of writing the terrific book Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, when we return here on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, we got the good news that a Jew had been elected mayor of the German city of Frankfurt, the first such major city to elect a Jew since the rise of Adolf Hitler 70 years ago. This week, we got the bad news, also from Germany, that Nobel Prize-winning author Günter Grass, who wrote The Tin Drum and many other novels and poems, had published a poem on the front page of some German papers excoriating Israel and calling Israel the danger to world peace. You know, this would normally upset me, and probably the whole Jewish intelligentsia in the world, except that one must consider the source. Günter Grass is a great writer, at least in talent, if you exempt the moral source of literature. But Grass, a left-wing activist as well as a writer, also managed to conceal his service in the Nazi Waffen-SS for some 62 years, only going public with that in 2006 when he was publishing his memoirs. Günter Grass has never had anything positive to say about Israel, and his general German guilt about World War II and the Holocaust has always, strangely, focused on creating the idea that ordinary Germans were essentially victims of fascism and the Allied bombing. In Gross's latest poem, he blames the Jewish state for endangering world peace. Israel. Not Iran, not Syria, not North Korea, not, well, the list goes on and on. Real threats to world peace. You know, it's always easier to blame the Jews, isn't it? Three important Jewish obituaries this week, all very different people who helped shape our world and our ideas. First, Mike Wallace, the brilliant journalist and devastating interviewer who made the weekly show 60 Minutes, the most compelling hour of television news in history, died. Wallace was 93 and lived a colorful life. Born Myron Wallach in Brookline, Massachusetts, married four times, he was a genius, questioning in a sharp, even harsh way, without totally antagonizing his victims, or interview subjects. As his comrade Harry Reasoner said of Wallace, "There's one thing that Mike can do better than anyone else. With an angelic smile, he can ask a question that would get anyone else smashed in the face." Judaism is, of course, based on learning through questioning, but Wallace's sharp questioning of Israeli public figures and his willingness to criticize Israeli policies over the years got him much criticism. But as he said on the subject, "Occasionally down the years I've winced at being labeled a self-hating Jew because my reporting from the Middle East was perceived as tainted by hostility towards Israel. It wasn't true, of course, but I figured it came with the territory, meaning that I was deemed biased because I reported accurately what was happening on the other side with the Palestinians. And it turned out that every once in a while it was helpful to me as a reporter, for the fact that I am Jewish and not in the pocket of the Israelis seemed to appeal to movers and shakers in Cairo and Damascus and Riyadh who were willing to talk to me on the record with some candor. I've worked the Middle East beat since the 1950s, back in the days of Moshe Dayan, Golda Meir, Menachem Begin, Anwar Sadat, Yasser Arafat, Muammar Gaddafi. My relations with all of them, with the sole exception of Begin, were cordial and straightforward. But when I questioned Begin in a fashion that I thought reasonable and he found belligerent, our conversation was brought to an end by the intervention of Ezer Weitzman, his defense minister, who shortly afterward took me for a friendly drink at a nearby bar. I have long admired the courage and determination of the Israelis and sympathized with their yearning for a secure state," Mike Wallace said. "I have similar feelings about the Palestinians, but I'm an American reporter, a Jew who believes in going after facts on the ground and reporting them accurately. Let the chips fall where they may." Another obituary, Jack Tramiel, was a hard-nosed businessman, a Holocaust survivor of Auschwitz, who changed the home computer world dramatically through the development of inexpensive, capable computers that helped drive the nascent industry in the early 80s. His Commodore computer company was a tough early competitor to Apple, and he helped move the home computer from its nerd using a kit to build an expensive toy stage to its ubiquitous presence in every part of our lives. "You know, I worked in the home computer software field in the early 80s, and Commodore was known for producing cheap machines with a ton of capability, at a time when Apple was known for producing medium-priced machines that you could expand into useful tools if you knew what you were doing. In its era, the TRS-80 was a cutting-edge machine, and the Commodore Amiga was the most sophisticated mass-market home computer of its era." That was all because of Jack Tramiel. And finally, the great American Jewish poet Adrienne Rich died on March 17th. She was a powerful, moving, beautiful writer who believed that poetry is not to be taken lightly or frivolously, that it was much more than decorative language. As a feminist, a lesbian, and a Jew, she wrote modern poems that were often stunning and always good. My favorite poem of hers is called For Memory, and it ends like this. "The past is not a husk, yet change goes on. Freedom. It isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose-bound, routine remembering, putting together inch by inch the starry worlds from all the lost collections." May Adrienne Rich's memory only bring blessing. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Raya Hakakian, an author and poet. Her memoir, Journey from the Land of No, about her girlhood in revolutionary Iran and her move to the United States as a Jewish teenager, is really fascinating. And her book, Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, about Iran's terror campaign against exiled Iranian dissidents in the West, has received tremendous attention just last year. Raya, tell me a little bit about the Jewish community in Iran. You know, people just don't realize how extensive and I think how integrated into Iranian society it was before the revolution.
That's right. I think, you know, the 50s, the 1950s, the 60s, and the 70s were, in many ways, the golden years of multiculturalism for Iran. And they came about because the Shah of Iran, who represented the last dynasty that was subsequently overthrown in 1979, really wanted and accomplished the job of urbanization, industrialization, and modernization of Iran to a great extent. And I think he recognized that in doing so, he needed the whole nation to identify itself as one people rather than a divided nation of various tribes or hostile ethnicities. And therefore, the Shah did a great deal, as did his father, in dismantling Jewish ghettos and lessening the amount of ethnic division that existed in Iran. And therefore, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s were great years for Jewish life in Iran. People, namely Jews, had mostly moved out of the ghettos. And although certain aspects of anti-Semitism continued to exist in Iran as they did in everywhere else in the world, there had been a great improvement in Jewish-Muslim relations and in the ways that Jews had infiltrated pretty much every high office, be it in academic or even government office in Iran, which is really remarkable.
After the revolutionary takeover, Khomeini, who allied himself with all of the dissident groups and then broke his promise to all of them and instituted, you know, Islamic law and created Hezbollah, became a very difficult place to live for Jews rapidly, came to the United States. And in the course of your experience, you know, you sort of had to learn a new language, a new tradition, a new custom. What led you to becoming an author in your new language?
I knew from the age of 9, 10, 11 that I wanted to become a writer, and the fact that I wasn't good at anything else in life really helped. I had two left feet, I couldn't dance, I basically stank at everything else too, so this was, you know, the only avenue that I happen to be decent at. When I got here, I continued to write in Persian for many, many years, in part because at first I thought that we would someday go back, and why start in writing another in another language if, you know, if it would pick up and go back to live in Iran again. But later on, when it became clear that we wouldn't be going back, I started really thinking about English in a different way, and then came across people who inspired me in ways that, having read them, had not. For instance, I took a course at Brooklyn College with Allen Ginsberg, and you know, being around him was probably among the most important and formative experiences of my life in America. I think it was after I realized that, you know, I could still have another niche community here, people who feel as familiar and as and are as loving and lovable as Alan, made me feel that I could, you know, spread my roots here again. I could find a place in this new language among these people, and little by little, I started to dare to write in English, which he had a lot to do with.
That's great. Allen Ginsberg, of course, the great poet, the author of Howl and so many other dramatic and powerful
Kaddish.
Poetry. And Kaddish, of course, from a Jewish perspective. Your book, The Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, is about Iran's terror campaign against dissidents. Tell us how you came to write it and what challenges you faced.
I'm so glad I've never talked about this on a Jewish program. Because in many ways I love talking about how this subject, which seems like it would have nothing to do with my Jewishness, is very much something that I picked up precisely because of the ways in which my perspective on things is filtered through my own Jewish identity. You know, when I first wanted to think about the second book, a lot of people, including my former editor, who was very happy with my memoir, said to me that I ought to think about a second memoir because my first one really doesn't bring my life up to date to, you know, to recent times. It ends in 1984. And she wanted to encourage me to write a sequel to that. And first of all, I didn't want to. I thought that an artist needs to define her own career, her own interests, and not become a cottage industry of repetitive or, you know, similar exercises. But also I thought, you know, what is it that I need to be telling the community around me, the Americans, about what I have witnessed? What is the value of what I saw, both as a refugee coming to America and a witness to a major transformation in Iran, the revolution, the subsequent war with Iraq, and kind of a person who tries to take away from her own Jewish identity, the most important lesson of never forgetting. And I thought that the story that I tell in The Assassins of the Turquoise Palace is just such a tale, that if we were to apply, or if I applied, the most valuable Jewish principle to something that I think is indispensable about Iran and knowing and about learning the Iranian history, contemporary Iranian history, what would it be? And the answer was that book, was to tell the story of the people whose tales go untold in all the millions of headlines that keep being generated about nuclear Iran and its, you know, imminent war with Israel. You know, the stories of other Iranians, expatriates, who have become victims, but who are completely unknown throughout the world. And so I did it, basically decided to do it for that reason. But then, fortunately, it just also happens to be a fantastic crime story that leads to a courtroom drama and has a wonderfully happy ending.
You know, it's an extraordinary ending. It's not what you expect, sort of.
Right.
Because, you know, we hear so many terrible things. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's, you know, we have been trying as the international community, as a unified international community.
I should note you're a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center since 2004, and you've been very active in human rights throughout that period.
Right. Thank you. You know, people have been trying to figure out the proper formula, so to speak, to approach Iran and force Iran, or namely Tehran, to play by international rules, to stop enriching uranium. And none of these things that the international community has done seems to work, except this case that I recount in this, in Assassins of the Turquoise Palace. You know, it talks about the story of an assassination, which took place in September 17, 1992, when two members of the Lebanese Hezbollah, under orders from Iran, walk into a meeting of the Iranian opposition and some Iranian Kurds and shoot them all at a restaurant in Berlin, Germany, and four of them die instantly. And then, you know, the fact that this crime happens in Berlin, Germany, and you know, a fabulous, noble prosecutor gets assigned to work on this case is important from a Jewish perspective, in that all of this quest for justice was happening in the backdrop of the Holocaust and the fact that no matter how dirty certain German politicians were in those years and perhaps continue to be, the existence of the experience and the memory of what had happened during the years of the World War II, had a lot to do with the way justice was delivered to these victims. And I should say, in a most remarkable and historic way, that so many of these assassinations had occurred around the world, you know, in Switzerland, in France, in Austria, and never before had these victims in a similar position gotten any justice except for in Germany. And I think, you know, we always think about the Holocaust and all the terrible destruction that it brought about. And in this one case, perhaps, we can see the good that came from it, that as a result of the heavy weight of the guilty German conscience, the lawyers, the justices, the prosecutors who got involved with this case did not bend under the pressure of corrupt officials, and you know, really took care of these survivors and victims from this assassination. And it culminated in a verdict that, according to all the legal scholars I spoke to, adds up to be the most important verdict in the history of Germany since World War II.
It's an extraordinary story and a terrific book, Assassins of the Turquoise Palace. Roya, I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Roya Hakakian.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. when our guest will be Andrew Nagorski, the author of the fascinating book Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. Really interesting book. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout, for the first time in a long while, has nothing whatsoever to do with Passover. It's from Israeli singer Rami Kleinstein. It's called Tapuzim Utmarim, Apples and Dates. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
מוציאה עוד ממחתה הרוכלים לה צועקים מה קרה לחמודה זה אהובי שלא רוצה ומה
מצא לו נערה. קחי לך תפוחים ותמרים, המתיקי את יומך, הוא לא שווה את הכאב שמתרוצץ אצלך בלב. היא אוהבת את האיש שלא אוהב אותה, שמלת פרחים לחיים שושנים, לך לא מספיקים. אתה רוצה אישה בלגת בלי ניסיון חיים, אתה רוצה ילדה נערה קפואה ובלי קמטים. קחי לך תפוחים ותמרים, המתיקי את יומך, הוא לא שווה דקר שמתרוצץ אצלך בלב. נה 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 אתה תרצה אותה אהובה רק שנוח ומדהים.